House Committee on Judiciary to order February 3rd. We have a little business to do before we get to the bills. We're going to have some hearings on. You want to let us know what you've got there so I can give them to the co-chair over here?
Thank you, co-chairs, members. I have four LCs before me for introduction as bills. First, LC 3119, date 1711. Second, LC 3120, date 11011. Third, LC 3215, date 2211. And finally, LC 3243-2311.
Co-Chair Krieger, I move that LC 3119, dated 1711, LC 3120, dated 11011, LC 3215, dated 2211, and LC 3243, dated 2311, be introduced as committee bills.
Thank you. Keep in mind that we'll be putting these into the process. This is what we're doing. It does not mean that any of us have a commitment to vote for that bill. Are there any objections to those being introduced? If not, so ordered. Okay, we're going to have a public hearing on which one is Representative Grenlick here on? 2225? Is that right? We'll do that first then. Open a public hearing on 2225, Representative Grenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring my blue band.
You sure can.
He's going to be the one to have the gavel. Thank you, Co-Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much for hearing this bill. I'm just going to briefly introduce it. And, for the record, I'm State Representative Mitch Grenlick, House District 33, and I'm going to let my L.A. talk very briefly about some substance. First thing I want to make sure about this bill, which will allow citizens to videotape police working in their official duties, is that this is not about police misconduct. I was walking downtown in Portland last week, and I saw a marvelous example of a young policeman dealing with somebody who was in trouble and working very hard. A person laying on the sidewalk, and the policeman was working with him, saying, "Come on now, I'm here to help you. You know, sit up, let's talk. What's going on?" I thought, actually, it would be nice to videotape this young policeman doing what he was doing and send it to his superiors to show what a great job, and maybe think about how so often policemen do marvelous things. We only hear about it when something goes bad. But what triggered this, and you'll hear a little bit more about it in a moment, was the fact that a couple of citizens were arrested because they whipped out their cell phone or a video camera and videotaped policemen in their course of action in the public. And it seemed to me that's very odd. And when we began to look into it, we found out this was the statute that's being amended here that does not provide clear authorization for a citizen to do that. And this proposal is a draft of a way to allow that to happen. Let me start with you, Mr. Chair, turn over.
That's fine.
Testimony.
He just identify yourself and continue.
Co-Chair Parker and Krieger, members of the committee. My name's Justin, for the record. I'm a legislative assistant to...
Both names.
Oh, Justin Freeman, legislative assistant to Representative Mitch Grenlick, House District 33. The reason we introduced this bill was really we have a fundamental belief that more government transparency and accountability is in the public good, and this is merely an attempt to reinforce that belief. Like Representative Grenlick said, we are not trying to demonize or punish police officers in any way. It's just a transparency issue. And in some cases, it may lead to, a law enforcement officer accused of wrongdoing may be exonerated by videotape. You know, it can go either way. I talked to the public information officer with the Portland Police Bureau, and I don't want to speak for her, but she made it pretty clear that people recording police officers while in public and on duty happens all the time anyways, and it's pretty unclear what the standards and regulations are in those kind of incidents. And we're hoping that with this bill we can clarify, you know, how both parties, the public and the police, should act in that situation. There were two incidents, which Representative Greenleck alluded to, that got some media attention in the recent past. Both were actually within the span of 2 months of 2008. The first involved a person named Mike Tabor in Portland, and that was in September of 2008. He was videotaping two police officers who were interrogating two men on the street that were law enforcement suspected of being involved in a drug deal. After letting the two men go, because they didn't have sufficient evidence, they became irritated by Mr. Tabor, who was videotaping them with a video camera, not a cell phone, an actual video camera, and confiscated his phone. About 2 minutes later, Mr. Tabor walked to the central precinct and got his phone back, but was also given a ticket. He threatened to sue the Multnomah County DA, refused to prosecute the case, as far as I know, but Mr. Tabor threatened to sue the city for $100, which led Portland city attorneys to kind of investigate how, you know, what the proper protocol should have been in that situation. They decided, they sent a memo, an internal memo, to Portland police that in most cases, except in rare circumstances, they should allow the public to videotape them merely because their appearance, it raises questions about, you know, it looks like they're trying to cover something up, basically. And the second incident that got some media attention was in Beaverton. Mr. Hao Sheng Bang, I hope I pronounced that right, that was in August of 2008, made an audio recording of his friend being arrested in a bowling alley. The police arrested Bang and confiscated his cell phone. He was held overnight. They actually deleted the audio file, and the officer was later reprimanded for that, but that's neither here nor there. Mr. Bang sued the city of Beaverton, and after a couple years of litigation, was awarded it was settled for $19,000, which didn't cover his legal fees, but it did, but his attorney agreed to cover the rest. And that actually led Beaverton city attorneys to write a memo as well, which is committee administrator to hand out. You should have a copy of that. It's the photocopy. Looks like it's been photocopied 20 times. But it makes some pretty interesting points. The most important point is the memo instructed police officers to assume at all times you're being recorded. So in most situations that I'm aware of, police, when they're in public and on duty, are acting as though they're being recorded at all times anyways. But it did make a couple important points. ORS 165.543 prohibits the interception of a conversation between two parties without their consent. But the two parties recorded must have a reasonable expectation of privacy for the law to apply, and the memo says that in most cases, police while on duty and in public do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And also ORS 165.540 prohibits recording an oral conversation between two or more people when all the participants are not specifically informed that they're being recorded. But the city attorneys determined that the act of holding up a cell phone and pointing it in the officer's direction is basically specifically informing them that they're being recorded. So that's kind of this should demonstrate that there's a lot of uncertainty. It's not clear through statute. We're needing city attorneys to, you know, send internal memos to the police bureau explaining what the protocol is. And we're just hoping to, through this legislation, clarify, you know, the proper protocol. And we understand there's various concerns, and we're happy to work with members of the committee and stakeholders to accommodate those concerns.
Okay. Committee, have any questions? Representative Parker?
A comment. I've been filmed numerous times, and when I was working, and I think we should be able to to do a video recording. What the concern I've heard on this bill really doesn't address is the surreptitious recording, somebody coming up and trying to provoke an incident and recording secretly. And that I know isn't what you or Representative Greenleck are looking for. So, but we do want to have it clear that it is legal to film. One time on a local cable TV show in Portland with Bruce Broussard used to have there, they asked me about this years ago, and I said it's fine, but the public needs to be aware, too, that if I'm arresting somebody or in a fight or something and somebody comes running up with something in their hand, it puts everybody at great danger. And so those are the kind of things that need to be careful. A silver cell phone at night could be, you know, so those kind of things you just need to think about and the public needs to think about. But you should be able to film police doing their work without being arrested. I'd agree with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't see anything in the proposed House bill that would prohibit or govern in any way kind of selective editing of any of this footage. Is that an issue that you guys considered?
No, I think that's an issue if it went to court or something that you'd have to determine whether there was 18 minutes missing out of this.
This is simply to
allow an exemption from the restrictions
of privately recording something for this particular.
It doesn't talk about the content of
or what you do with it, or what the standing of that recording is.
It simply protects the ability to do the recording and not what you use it for.
Any further?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Olson.
Thank you. Representative Greenleck, I'm of the opinion that, you know, like with my cell phone and so many of us have the ability to record immediately. And as
those of us that know how to use it.
Hey, you know what? We have some people here who are probably technically challenged. I realize that. But we have also some, like representative over here on my right, knows how to use it. We could give you the training.
Okay.
I'm thinking to myself, if I were stopped for a traffic violation on the freeway today, and I all of a sudden things go south with me in the contact with the officer, I can easily pull this thing out. I can set it right between us as we have the conversation, and I can and take the step toward letting the officer know that he's being recorded. That's how easy it is for me. So I'm struggling a little bit with where you're wanting to go with this because of having that right to be able to use this, of having to then, you know, mandate it like this in law. I'm just curious your thoughts.
Representative Olson, I think my reading is that if you did what you just said, you'd be violating the law right now. And all this would allow that, all this would do is allow you to do what you just said.
He said, if he said, I'm going to record you, you can do that.
That's right. That's a different.
Yeah.
That's right. If he said, I want this on the record, I'm going to record you now, and here I'm going to do it. You can do that. If he just did it, yeah, even though he was visually doing it, that would be a violation of the law.
And the chief, I've spoke with the chief of police of Beaverton, he would like clarification on the law as well, so thank you for your...
I think you may get some testimony and some other clarifications that people like. We'd love to work with him to make sure it gets clarified.
Anything further? Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to call up people who are in favor of it, and one of you didn't mark down whether you were or not. Eugene Dayton, is it pro? Kevin says Douglas, but Palangda? Can you read that name?
Pringleda.
Is that person here?
You're calling Eugene Pringle.
That must be you. Are you for or against this?
Well, I don't know if I signed up for the right bill or not. I was here more for the drunk driving.
Okay, different bill.
I'll just mark you off then.
Okay, yeah. But I'm in favor of anything that would give the public the right to videotape or tape record police officer.
All right, then, Brian Walshmit, would you come on up? Do you have anyone else that's going to come up with you? John Powell?
Do you want the paper first?
We can do that if you want.
Oh, sorry.
No, no, just get him up here. Yeah, it's still a good bill.
Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, just for introductions, I think most of you know who I am. I'm Brian Walshmit. I represent a number of public safety organizations. I'm here on behalf of the 5,500-member Oregon Council of Police Associations, which is local law enforcement. I'm also here on behalf of the Oregon State Police Officers Association, your state troopers. This morning, I had a discussion with Representative Greenlick on the bill. He asked me to come in and talk to him. And at that point, I agreed to express our concern about the bill, but also express that we're willing to continue to have a dialogue with him about his concerns. But with that said, I think our position is that we're obviously opposed to the bill in its current form. I don't believe that we're opposed to the incidental recording, but this bill would send a signal that it's okay for organized groups and individuals to intentionally follow a police officer for the purposes of recordation, and that's our main concern with the bill. In doing so, they would either potentially interfere with the operation and duties of the police officer, put themselves or the police officer or other general public in the line of fire, potentially, as Representative Barker's talked about, an incident at night where you've engaged in this conduct and all of a sudden somebody's coming out of the side with an object. It could be that the suspect, in fact, does have a firearm and is drawing that firearm, and you have other people that are attempting to videotape that. You're putting them in the line of fire. A police officer obviously has to worry about their safety, but also their primary function is to protect the general public. So obviously that would be a concern. Interestingly enough, I don't know how many of you know this, but over the last several number of sessions, we've struggled with the flip side of this. What is the responsibility of a police officer to let the general public know on a stop whether they're being recorded or not being recorded? So if you look at the statute on that side, the bill actually gives much more leniency to the general public to not notify the officer and do a recording without the officer's notice being noticed. But at the same time, the officer has to make every due attempt to identify and indicate to a stop or a suspect that they are potentially being recorded. So it's an interesting dynamic that we're going clear one way on the one statute, and on the other hand, a police officer cannot just have somebody assume that they're being recorded because they've stopped with a car and there may be a camera in that car, or that the officer may have a recorder in their hand. That's not enough to identify. They have to make every effort to let that officer know. So with that, I'll end. Again, I have committed to the chief sponsor that we'll continue to work with him, but in its current form, we do have strong opposition. Thank you.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elizabeth Cushwell, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The district attorneys are opposed to the bill in its current form, basically because you are not allowed to secretly record your neighbors. You are not allowed to secretly record your legislators, and I will admit to, in my previous life as a contract lobbyist, maybe that would have been nice. But in this case, we prefer that the law remain the way it is now. And if you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Chairman, John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. We're opposed to House Bill 2225. And Mr. Chairman, I would not go over the same ground that's been covered, but simply point out lines 16 through 19 of the bill, what is currently prohibited. And that is to use a device basically of any kind to record somebody who doesn't know they're being recorded. And then it exempts on line 24 of page 2, it exempts an enforcement officer acting in the officer's official capacity, which would allow somebody from organized crime, as I read the bill, to use spot and point recording devices through the window of a police agency to record what's going on inside. Those people are acting in their official capacity, and you can use a device of any kind. And with the growth of technology, I think that this has a lot of potential downside. Thank you.
Questions? I'm going to let you off easy.
Thank you.
Is it Michael Slavinson? Slavinson? That's what it looks like.
That's awesome.
It's awesome.
With the V's on me. Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slosson, with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm a Senior Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Division of the department. I checked on the box that the department is opposed to the bill, but in reality, we have some concerns. And the primary concerns is that this statute would apply, or this amendment would apply in situations not just when officers are on the street, but in any kind of investigation. So you might have a complex murder investigation. It could apply in the course, in the scope of an interview with a potential suspect. As you know, we have public records laws, exceptions for releasing criminal investigatory materials, because controlling the flow of information in a criminal investigation is critical to that investigation. I realize that people are interviewed could share their interview with other folks, but that's a different by quite a bit from somebody who actually has a recording of that. And just reiterate too that you can record, it's just you have to give notification that you're recording. And one thing that maybe the committee would want to take a look at in the statute is that there is an exception for unconcealed recording device under sub 6 of the statute. When you have an unconcealed recording device and you're in a private meeting, and you're recording a private meeting, and everybody should have known, or reasonably should have known, that the recording was being made. Now, I deal with this law a lot in the course of my work, and I've done legislative history research on it, and I can tell the committee that there's nothing in particular on the definition of a private meeting, but it could apply through some interpretation. So it's not clear, I don't think, just to say under the law that if a person is recording an officer in a meeting with somebody else and the device is unconcealed, that necessarily violates the statute. Nothing else? Any questions?
Somebody?
Thank you. I'm not sure if you're the person to whom I should direct this question, but I was thinking about the times we are recorded. I think without being notified, for instance, when you go into a small grocery store, maybe a big grocery store, I don't know, certainly TriMet stops. It seems to me that there are a lot of places where we're being recorded where I'm not consciously aware that recording is going on.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, Representative May, under the statute, you would have to have, you'd have to be specifically informed under subsection C of the statute. So if somebody of a grocery store, TriMet, somebody is recording your conversations without specifically informing you, that would violate the statute. So maybe in the situations in which when you're hearing those types of buildings, there would be some posted notices or something like that. But there has to be something to that effect. Otherwise, it would be a violation of state law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Nolan?
Thank you. To clarify the section of statute that you cited with regard to private meetings, can you help me understand what an unconcealed device is? Putting something that doesn't look like a recording device but actually happens to be one out in plain sight on the tabletop, is that unconcealed, or is the fact that it looks like a pad of paper but it's actually a tape recorder or digital recorder now, is this unconcealed, or do I have to say, everybody here understand that this is a recording device?
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, Representative Nolan, that's a good question, and I have dealt with that particular issue in the course of my work. The way the Oregon Supreme Court interprets statutes is to give words their ordinary meaning. I looked at the dictionary definition of that. The definition of concealed would, in my interpretation of it, include what you're talking about. So if I have a device that's not easily recognizable as a recording device, then that would be concealed. In other words, it wouldn't have to be, you know, not visible, but the purpose of the device would have to be not easily determined or unrevealed. So if you had, you know, the secret, the glasses or something like that, and you're videotaping with recording or something, and it's not recognizable as a recording device, I think that would apply. As being concealed, that would be a concealed device.
That pertains to private meetings, and there's certainly some leeway and a little bit of art in how you define private meetings, but Representative Tomei raised a question about what could arguably be considered public settings. When I walk into a grocery store, or I go to a TriMet stop, or I even approach a traffic intersection where there are surveillance cameras, I'm not in a private setting. Does there have to be notice of those recording devices?
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, Representative Nolan, I would say that there would have to be notice, because in those situations, the statute also defines another particular provision I was talking about. If you have an unconcealed recording device, it's not a violation if you do it in public or semi-public meetings, such as hearings before governmental or quasi-governmental bodies, trials, press conferences, public speeches, rallies, or sporting other events. So the statute defines kind of what we refer to as public meetings, and again, there's no legislative history on those provisions. But the way I see the law is that if you are in a grocery store and you're having a conversation with one individual, that is not a public meeting. That is not a public conversation. So under that statute, just because you're in the particular grocery store, the grocery store would have to give you notice that the grocery store is recording your conversations, and I distinguish between recording you visually and recording you audibly.
Thanks for your help. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything further? Thank you. Andrea Meyer.
Good afternoon, co-chair members of the committee. I'm Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. We are here in support, but we actually too, want amendments to this to provide more restrictions. The problem we're encountering is a change in technology. 10, 15, 20 years ago, we didn't have cell phones that not only recorded a picture, but also record an audio. And I think you've heard that there is confusion. City of Portland, Beaverton already has some rules. I think, Chair Barker, you talked about we really do need to clarify this. Our concern is making sure that we provide exceptions to the law that are narrow, because we don't want to open up to allow basically for us to record, you know, the surreptitious recording that you spoke about. And I think we can try to fix this so we avoid the surreptitious. Should not be the microphone hidden away. But I think we also know that there are risks to an actual arrest that are arising as a result. A few of the issues, you know, the risk to an officer when they are, and I think most of the situations we're really thinking about are situations where someone is a witness. So I would distinguish that between the traffic stop, which I'll get back to in a minute, and people who are a witness. I think the law enforcement has all the tools it already has and should use them as appropriate to instructing people to move back, move away, and if they violate any statute in interfering, those tools are available. This does not make an exception to the tools law enforcement has to control the scene. But that also shouldn't be a basis to restrict someone videotaping when they're not interfering. We already deal with a big exception, which is, and I know there was conversation about an organized group following. The media already can do this. Now, this exists. You've all seen the cameras rolling. They're not only taking visual, they're taking audio. you know, we have an interesting tension developing with bloggers and who's media and who's not, and I think we should avoid that by fixing this law. There's been, I believe, I didn't research it, I think ACLU got involved in Oregon on a case because the person was asserting that they were media. That's the tension we're often going to create. I think we need to resolve. The law enforcement stop, Representative Olson, I almost wonder if, because the statute talks about you must inform the other that a conversation is happening, that usually means Representative Barker says, Andrea, I'm taping you, I can walk away. If I'm not, you can either ask him, please don't do that, and he can say, I'm going to continue, and I can walk away. I'm not sure if I were pulled over at a traffic stop and I informed the officer, I'm recording the audio of this, and you are, you know, whether if the officer did not want to be recorded, how that dynamic would play out. I don't think the officer would choose to walk away from the traffic stop at that point. So I think we're really talking about the situations of witnesses. Representative Juan, you talked about the concern of cutting and pasting. We already deal with that. We deal with that with the media or anyone else who is under the media in terms of that. That is a risk. Anyone could take my testimony right now. This is being recorded. It's an authorized recording. And cut and paste. That's just the balance we deal with, and we deal with it mostly with elected and public officials and people who are public and police officers are. I also want to note, because you know there is an exception to the law already, and it you know was a hard one for us, but it is, if you look at page 2, lines 17 to 21, does allow police officers who have the camera mounted on their car and who's operating a vehicle and on a camera to tape. And the only duty they have is, well, it says a law enforcement who is in uniform displaying a badge who's operating that camera that's in front or within the surrounding police vehicle, unless the officer has a reasonable opportunity to inform the participants. So, in other words, translated, we provide an exception for police officers and the camera on the car, and all they have to do is make a reasonable opportunity. And that may not arise at the beginning of the traffic stop or when they arrive at a scene and things are chaos. So we really lessen the requirement in that situation, and I think we need to lessen the requirement in this situation. I want to distinguish, I'm not sure if this is the case, I think TriMet probably has signs, but a lot of places do a visual recording, and maybe the safest stores do. What we're talking about is when you start capturing the audio. That's where it becomes this law applies. And so we are becoming a surveillance society and seeing a lot of cameras. And when it does not capture audio, it's not violating the law. We would not only be happy to work with the sponsor, we really do urge this committee to move forward with this, because I will end with something I began. Confusion in the law, local jurisdictions already needing to provide officers the guidance. Let's provide it in statute and make it clear when and where it is permissible and otherwise not. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, committee? Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Meyer, how would you address the concern about protecting the privacy of law enforcement conversations that are planning operations that in the public interest should not be made public? If they're planning a sting or they're planning a raid or they're having a strategy conversation, how can we protect those and still meet the objectives you're trying to pursue?
Co-chairs, Representative Nolan, I see this law existing mostly in, but not exclusively, to public spaces. If you're talking about situations where officers are collaborating with each other and someone is, so the videotape has to be open and showing, I don't think most of these cameras are going to capture, I'm not going to get close enough. So if you're in the public situation, there's a risk. The media camera is actually probably more powerful, and the media is usually there when there's a law enforcement action where there's actually decision-making and discussion happening at the scene. They usually, I believe, and I'm speaking to folks who are more experienced than I in terms of this, take or rope off an area when there's an ongoing situation where they can not only avoid anyone interfering, but they also remove the risk, I assume, of the cameras from the TV stations, which are probably have more powerful microphones than anyone that generally people are walking around. Maybe not. I think their technology may be more advanced, but I'm not an expert on the cell phones. But I think their audio equipment. So I think we already, to the degree that that's already dealt with when it's a public space with the TV, that's already handled. And I don't think this creates new risks that officers aren't dealing with when they're dealing with a situation where they need to not have a public conversation. I also want to note that I do not believe, for the most part, that the vehicle-mounted video cameras that arrive at a house with a bunch of people on the sidewalk and there's no arrest or anything, I believe that's public record. I believe that videotape is. We already have the situations where law enforcement, in this case only law enforcement, is capturing the public without the public necessarily knowing and creating a public record which is accessible to everyone. So I'm not sure I fully answered your question.
Quick follow-up, and maybe not so much a question as just a kind of wrapping it together. I think it's a legitimate question that Representative Greenlick and Chair Barker have brought before us. And in the course of some of the conversations, someone who wasn't you, a previous witness, referred to the right to be a witness. And the extent to which this bill is intended to essentially facilitate the clarity of someone's witnessing, I think it is appropriate and something we should move forward with to make sure that what they are presenting as their witness is in fact that legitimate to what really happened. But if it steps over the bounds to interfering with police work, and I'm sure that's not the intent of the co-chair, that would be something that would be a bit more concerning. So the concept, I think, is great, and thank you for bringing it. But it sounds like the bill probably needs a little bit of work to achieve that objective.
I think, first of all, you know, the technology is out there. It's been happening. I mean, this is not creating something new that's not being done. The problem is it is being done, and people are being subjected to potential criminal. So I think we already know what can happen, and I think there is absolutely nothing in this statute that removes the issues around interference or other authorities that law enforcement have to control the scene. You know, the risk we take, even once we clarify this, is, and I think it's a minimal risk, I'd hope, is the officer seeing a taping going on and using their authority to, say, move further back than would really be necessary, but for the purposes to eliminate the eyes. But I think officers always deal with the eyes when they're doing arrests and engaging in the public. That exists with or without a camera. There are people who watch. That happens all the time. So I don't think this really creates a new risk because, first of all, it's ongoing, and second of all, the people are already there.
Anything further? Representative Warren?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, my concern with selective editing is really these officers are uniformed, representing an entire department. And, you know, by the time a court gets the chance to rule on an issue of selective editing, oh, you took out 50 seconds right in the middle that made it all different. You know, we could have a real problem with the public order. And in a day and age where you can record something and then text it to 50 of your buddies, and within a half an hour that's global or viral on the internet, and nobody has had the chance to respond, I just think we need to really carefully consider what kind of can of worms we could be opening up here and how best to protect from people using this as a way to mislead and incite. So those are my concerns.
Co-chairs and Representative Wong. The first issue raised in terms of whether selective editing, I'm not even sure, but I can certainly be wrong that there would be any basis for litigation on that. I think people are selectively edited. Sometimes it's done to take the cat or the animal and selectively edit to create a weird thing. I mean, it happens all the time. I'm not sure that there would be, and anyone can, as I said, selectively edit what I just said and run it on online as well as you. you know, I think the risk and the issues around viral, one, again, I can't reiterate enough, it's already happening. I mean, this is going on. I mean, you know, when was Rodney King and some of that, you know, and those whole issues that happened afterwards and capturing stuff. So we're not creating a new problem. We're really tightening up to make it more limited in terms of when you can do it and not be subject. We're fixing a problem, not creating a new one, I really do believe, because it is ongoing. You know, we already give, as I said, in that exception with the camera on the vehicle, a lot of people that the police officer may be capturing on that video to expose to the public already. An officer could be in the car or outside the range of the camera under the exception currently and capturing a lot of people. That is public record. Anyone could selectively edit it. It's not of the officer's conduct, most likely. It might be of you or me. So we're already at risk for this, too.
Well, just to follow up, you know, I was on the budget committee in the city of Troutdale when we fully funded a camera in every single police car in the city. And what's interesting about that is that, number one, it is an item of safety for the officers. It gives us the opportunity to see what happened. It gives us, as a local jurisdiction, the opportunity for risk management to determine whether the officer was engaged in wrongdoing or not. But more importantly, and critically different in my mind, is that it is a public record, and anyone can ask for it and get the complete video. And the complete video is also available to that jurisdiction, to that police officer, and to that police department, so that if somebody tries to misuse it or edit it in a way that's unfair, they have the original footage and they can point out why it's misleading, and they can do so quickly enough to protect themselves both in the public realm and with their attorneys and in the legal realm if they have to. My concern with this is that nobody involved, except for the person taking the footage, has access to the full, complete, and unedited footage. And what do you do if someone misuses that to the detriment of a particular officer or police department when you don't have access to the raw footage to correct the record? And I think that's something that we would be remiss in not fully considering on this particular bill. Thank you.
Co-chairs, Representative Wong, I mean, I agree that there are risks. I mean, I think there's already risks. For two reasons. One, because this is happening all over the country and all over the state already. So the risks exist. And two, in terms of who has control of it and what they can do, you already have that risk with media. We really do. And three, you know, people do cut and edit, and a lot of people become suspicious. I think folks are smarter than we think in terms of understanding that this is not what happened. It is a risk, but I think in terms of ensuring that we don't criminalize something and the balance, we need to do an error. We need to do a fix to address this area. Thank you.
Thank you. I think my wife cut and edited our wedding pictures. I'm not even there.
Thank you.
Representative Grenlick, it looks like you need to make some contacts, see if you can work something out, especially with the police side, of course.
Maybe DOJ, if you want to try that.
Happy to do so, sir.
Okay, thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2225, and Representative Barker will take over the next one.
Open the hearing on House Bill 2104. For a public hearing, first call up Karen Wheeler, Dr. John Gardine, and Jonathan Eames. I said that wrong, but sorry. Please go ahead in any order, just identify yourself for the record.
And members of the committee.
My name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Eviction Programs Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division, part of the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2104. The outpatient treatment system in Oregon serves 20,000 DUI clients annually, representing about half of all clients served in the outpatient system. These services are provided by over 300 private nonprofit organizations, tribal organizations, and community mental health programs throughout the state. And the Addictions and Mental Health Division certifies each of these programs and provides some funding to support indigent clients. The DUI treatment system produces good outcomes. For individuals referred to treatment as a result of a DUII, the completion rate is 79%. And the recidivism rate is low at 9.7%, less than 10%. Prior to 1999, the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund represented $5 million in other fund revenue to the division and was sufficient to pay for all indigent and partially indigent treatment, interlock devices for those who are unable to pay, and hearing and language interpreter services. In 1999, the fund was diverted for other purposes, and the fee contributing to the IDPF, or the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund, was reduced to $25. This event marked the beginning of a series of budget reductions that had a significant impact on the alcohol and drug system. During the 2002 special session and the 2003 regular session, had a $25 million biennial impact on the alcohol and drug treatment system. The most significant loss was experienced when the Oregon Health Plan standard program was cut altogether and then came back at a very reduced enrollment rate. Despite the appropriation of $4 million in 1999 when the IDPF was cut and diverted, cuts during the economic recession of the early 2000s contributed to the budget reductions equaling six times that amount. And the system has never fully recovered. The DUI population has remained consistent throughout the numbers of years, between 22,000 and 25,000 people annually. Since this population of client remains fairly steady, Addictions and Mental Health used a financial model to come up with a fee increase that would generate roughly $5 million, or get us back to that level, during the 11-13 biennium as a starting point for replenishing those funds. Currently, AMH blends a portion of the Intoxicated Driver Program remains, which equals $694,000 a biennium, with general funds, beer and wine tax funds, and federal black grants to support the publicly funded treatment system, including DUI offenders and all other clients. While 67% of DUI clients have incomes falling below 200% of federal poverty level, only roughly 9%, or 1,792 per biennium, of the DUII population can be served with the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund remaining in the division's budget. The addiction system serves less than 20% of those in need of services, and this is based on estimates from the National Survey on Drug Use and Control conducted by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. DUI offenders who are able to access publicly funded services use capacity that could be used for non-DUI clients, such as drug court clients, people getting out of institutions, correctional institutions, or people on community supervision. Oregon's system for managing DUI offenders is good. Most DUI offenders access treatment, are held accountable for following the conditions of their agreement with the court, and for many, a DUI is the first time they've had an opportunity to seriously look at their alcohol and drug use. Based on findings from a current long-term outcome study that the division is administering, at six-month follow-up, addiction treatment clients, including those with a history of DUII, reduced criminal activity, began associating with clean and sober friends, significantly reduced their alcohol and drug use, increased time spent on productive activities such as school and work, and earned more money through legal income. They also significantly reduced the amount of money they were spending on alcohol and drugs, which helped them pay their fines. Providing financial assistance to those DUI offenders unable to pay the full cost of treatment or the fees related to the ignition interlock devices is a good public safety policy. This policy relies on DUI offenders who are more able to pay the fine to support people who are less able to pay for treatment. I appreciate you hearing this bill today very much and would be happy to answer any questions whenever you'd like to ask them. Thank you.
Does anybody have any questions?
Thank you. Thank you, Karen. Thank you for bringing this bill to us. So you mentioned after 6 months there was reduced criminal activity. Do you have any studies that go further than 6 months?
Co-chair Barker, co-chair Krieger, Representative Tomei. This study that I referenced is actually currently underway. So the people that are participating in this study are coming from directly from the treatment providers in our system, and they are being followed. So we've already done the six-month interviews, and pretty soon here, within the next couple of months, we are doing the 12-month interviews. And it's all being done by NPC Research is our contractor conducting those interviews.
Follow-up? So you must have studies from previous accounts, right? I would assume, I understand this is a new group that's doing this current study, but from previous studies, say 5 years ago, especially when you had more money that was available, do you have any statistics from that time?
Co-chairs and Representative Tomei, we have periodically done some studies on outcomes, and other states and nationally have done studies to follow up on clients. However, we haven't done full-blown long-term outcome studies since I've been with the division, which is about 14 years. But we have other kinds of studies that match administrative data sets, for instance, with CAF data, LEDS data, and other data to determine the outcomes of clients that we serve.
So could you send us those materials, please?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Do that through the administrator. It would be helpful.
I got a question.
Okay, question.
Karen, I talked to you the other day, and it shows in the 4.9 by 2013, and it goes up to 6.9. What's going to keep this thing from building, is if you look at, you're going to get to the $5 million balance you want. It's obvious you're going to have that $5 million. It's going to go on. So do you plan on using that excess dollars or new money coming in to enhance that program, expand it, or what? Because it's obvious you're going to have more money beyond the $5
million. Yes. As I mentioned before, we picked a number based on what would get us back to around $5 million, and it was also based on a payment factor of about 76%, which is our historical information tells us that about 76% of the people actually pay the current fee of $25. It's difficult to project when the fee goes up how many people will pay that full fee, but yes, this system, what I would like in terms of a vision for this DUI system is to beef up the analytical capacity, do some studies, pay for, and I'm aware there's other bills related to interlock devices, and be able to help people that really need the assistance for treatment and those other things.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger and members of the committee. I appreciate this opportunity to speak in support of the Bill 2104.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, and for the record, my name is Dr. John Gardine. I am the Director of Behavioral Health and Research at ADAPT, which is a private nonprofit agency in Roseburg, Oregon, serving clients in Douglas, Josephine, and Coos County. We are prime contractor in those counties for many services and are a primary provider for DUI clients as well. ADAPT was founded in 1971 and has been working with DUI clients consistently that entire time. I wish I could say we had an extensive database that I could share with you, but funding is a little tight around providing services. So the ability to do research internally has been hampered. We're really pleased that AMH is now looking at longer-term outcomes to get the kind of data that Representative Tomei was talking about. I obviously am in support of this bill, and I'd just like to make a few quick points that might help. First of all, alcohol and drug problems, people with alcohol and drug problems do not, as a rule, seek treatment. They don't voluntarily seek to take care of their problems. That's unfortunate, but that's a fact of life. Second, when people are forced into treatment, which is the way they usually come to us, either by a court because of an offense, a DUI, because of a marriage issue, because of a job issue, or whatever the leverage is, they do very, very well. The more leverage there is, the better they do in treatment. I'm certain that many of you are aware of the success of drug courts, which is not dissimilar from a DUI referral. The outcomes in those settings are just stunning. They're very, very, very high. The same is true with our DUI population. Because of the leverage, we get very, very good outcomes. We seem to have to address, at least my experience is, that when I speak about alcohol and drug treatment, I seem to have to defend it just about everywhere I go, because the misconception is that treatment doesn't work. We can all, myself included, point to people, personal or for other reasons that we know, that have failed addiction treatment. But I would remind you that the failure rates of addiction treatment are very similar to the failure for diabetes treatment and hypertension and heart disease and just about every other chronic medical condition. So addiction treatment stacks up very, very well, and forced treatment works extremely well. I'm sure you are aware of the figures around money spent on alcohol and drug problems related to money saved. There have been several national studies in this regard. I don't know as we've done an actual state study. That would be a Karen question. But in national studies, for every dollar we spend on treatment for addiction-related problems, we save between $7 and $10 in other kinds of costs. The damage done, legal costs, loss of work, families broken up, children being placed in all sorts of issues.
The number one barrier, my final point, is the number one barrier to treatment is money. Clients, aside from not wanting treatment,
I think I just lost the sound. You can still hear me though, right? Okay. I'm Italian. I tend to speak loud anyhow. So. The number one barrier to treatment is aside from just the denial and not wanting treatment, is money for those who wish to seek treatment. Our DUI clients, a little bit different than the state sample, a little over half of them are at the 200% of federal poverty level, and so they are on a sliding scale with us. They pay less than what it costs for us to provide treatment. 10 to 15% of the DUI clients who come to us have no money and pay nothing, and therefore we subsidize their treatment as well. As a publicly funded agency in the state, we are required to provide treatment to anyone who presents at our door. We may not turn people away for inability to pay. That's part of our licensing agreement, which we gladly accept. However, when there's an opportunity to make up for what we cannot provide with increased funds, we get very excited, because there are many people that we would like to serve and we are unable to serve because of lack of resources. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I think you did just address what I was going to ask, but I wonder if you could say it again or perhaps re-hit the point. So I understand that ADAPT is not a for-profit enterprise.
It's a non-profit, yes.
Non-profit. Publicly funded?
Yes.
And you do have a current approach to indigent clients? Yes. Which is basically you take a hit financially, you just cover it for them, is that right?
Yes.
To say it that way, okay. So by increasing this fee, will that essentially be shifting the cost for those indigent clients from one sort of publicly funded or underfunded enterprise to potentially, I don't know how better to put this, somebody who's able to pay? Does that make any sense?
Yes. And
that's ultimately what we're trying to do here, is that right?
Well, it's more than actually shifting. It actually would open up a greater treatment capacity.
What I'm getting at, and I'm not saying it very well, the public is already paying for these indigent clients. Is that right?
Yes, most of it.
Yeah, because you're paid by tax dollars.
Well, we about 70% of our budget is tax dollars. We do get income from other sources, but the overwhelming majority is tax dollars.
Fees, public dollars is a better way of stating it, because you have some fees, court fees, assessments, and whatnot. So these are already public dollars that are paying for these indigent treatment, right?
Well, again, mostly. But we have private fees, too. I mean, we collect whatever fees we can. And as I said, about, in our case, a little over 45% of our DUI clients pay for their treatment. So, you know, we're not subsidizing everybody's treatment. But yes, for those we subsidize, the majority is state-subsidized and federal subsidy.
Okay, I mean, and that's the point I'm ultimately getting at here, is basically the public is already paying for indigent DUI treatment, is that right?
Mostly.
For the most part, okay.
Yes.
This fee, is that going to adequately address, not over-address, but adequately address the gap that you're currently seeing in your program?
You know, that would be probably a better question for Karen. From my perspective, any increase, and when we lost this funding, when I happen to have been here when the original bill fund was passed in 1981, and that allowed us to provide a level of care that we had been prevented from providing in the past. With limited money, you have to modify your treatments to equal the resources at hand. So instead of providing groups with 8 or 10 people, you have groups of 12 to 15 to 18 people, which may not sound like a huge difference to you, but the difference in quality of treatment is huge. But that's what we had to do. When we had that money, we were able to provide a much higher level of treatment and much better outcomes. So by replacing that money, that gets us back to the place where we can provide that quality of care. And I don't know, I've not been a part of any financial analysis to see where this puts us. I've read the reports, and it appears to put us back at the level we were. And if that's what it does, that's good news.
Yeah, to the extent you're familiar. And just one more question. So in your considered opinion as a treatment provider with decades of experience, I gather.
Yes.
Will this fee increase take DUIs off the road?
Well, it'll take more of them off the road, absolutely.
So, will this fee increase directly protect the public?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Wong?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. in looking at the situation, it appears to me that the genesis of the problem that we're experiencing now occurred in 1999 when these revenues were diverted for another purpose. And of course, that's 12 years ago. They're still paying off those bonded debts, which has caused you not to have the funding that you were promised. What assurances are in this bill that that won't happen again?
If you introduce yourself.
For the record, my name is Jonathan Eames. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Prevention Education Recovery Association. None. The legislature has the authority to take those dollars at any point that they want. We would hope that you wouldn't, but as any legislature cannot bind future legislatures, we would hope that they wouldn't be able to. Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. Again, Jonathan Eames from OPERA, Oregon Professional Education Recovery Association. I'd actually like to address Representative Hicks's concerns first, because I think it's important to understand the holistic nature of alcohol and drugs and how the effects of alcohol and drug can affect the entirety of state government and a number of state agencies. it shouldn't be just looked at that this increase of fee is burdening the public to some extent by, you know, increasing it or shifting the dollars. There, the effects, the negative effects and the costly effects of alcohol and drug reach in every area of state government. You can look at from the corrections department to public safety to especially healthcare, the effects of a chronic user of alcohol and drugs, that the costs dramatically outweigh any fee increase that's included in this legislation. So as far as protecting the state's dollars, I believe investment in prevention and getting these folks into treatment right away and preventing them from doing it again will save you far more dollars. And now it won't be dollars you can tag right now and you can say, you can draw a direct line, but the health care effects from someone who maybe runs into someone and gets a traumatic brain injury and who may be on Medicaid, and the cost of treating that person will far outweigh, I think, just the modest amount that's included as far as an increase of in this fee. So this is something that affects a lot of different areas in state government, and to it's not just in the alcohol and drug or the AMH world. There's numerous other state agencies this affects. So what I just wanted to say, I wanted to echo, I think they did a wonderful job presenting the issue. But OPERA is the statewide association that represents treatment providers here in Oregon, and we're very supportive of this concept. We serve a fraction of who we need to serve as far as people who have alcohol and drug abuse issues, and this legislation moves us further down the road of providing more treatment, more access to folks who wouldn't otherwise be able to access it and maybe end up in the correction system or the public safety system. I think it's wise to look at, you know, the offenders who actually have committed the crime to be able to increase the fee there to pay for folks who have problems with alcohol and drugs use. So we are very supportive and would welcome any questions.
Okay, thank you. Representative Tony.
Thank you very much. And thanks for your testimony, all of you. And you're absolutely right. These drivers affect the whole population, and most especially having been on the Human Services Committee for so many years, so many of the children who go into foster care are there because one or both parents are addicted to alcohol or drugs. What I would like to see, however, I'm certainly supportive of your programs. I would like to see more information about how effective your programs are and which are the more effective. We're looking at evidence-based practices. I'd like this committee to see more evidence of that, of these practices, how effective they are, and which of these programs should be supported. And longevity, again, longevity, longitudinal statistics would be great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hicks.
So it's in the bill that I'm reading, but could you clarify, perhaps, Mr. Eames, this fee would be charged to persons either entering diversion for DUII or have been convicted of DUII, right? So anybody who would be paying this fee has already entered a guilty plea or been convicted by a court of DUII, is that right? And does this bill also contain an option or a provision that the court may waive all or part of the fee in cases involving indigent defendants? And so does that mean, could you explain, I mean, you're nodding, and right, so I got to say for the record, because people can't hear that, but is there anything I said so far so good? Is that right? Okay, thanks. And just one more thing. So does that mean that if a person is in such financial circumstances that they're able to prove to a court that they're unable to pay this fee, there still is a provision for a judge to waive the fee? Please.
Yes.
Audibly. Okay?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. That's all.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much, panel. Mr. Pringle.
Mr. Chair, are you moving this today?
We're not.
Thank you. And it has a referral to Ways and Means, or not?
It does.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. My name is Eugene Dayton Pringle, Jr. I'm from Myrtle Creek, Oregon. And my testimony here today has to do with the ambiguity in the Motor Vehicle Code itself. I believe that there's a lack of definition of terms in the Motor Vehicle Code that does not provide the average citizen with meanings of terms. One of those terms is the term driving. Driving is not defined in Section 801 of the Motor Vehicle Code. It's defined nowhere in the code itself. Other states do define driving. Missouri defines driving as being paid to drive. The only place you'll find that term in Oregon's Motor Vehicle Code is in the Traffic Accident Insurance Report Form. It's a crash report form. And there, driving is defined. Without having definitions of terms, it's difficult to understand for people, the general public, to know what the vehicle code is talking about. And I would like to see more clarification to prevent citations from being issued that don't clarify what they're being issued for.
Someone's carrying
law suspended. What does it mean? Were they being paid to drive, or were they driving to the grocery store to get a carton of milk? Why? One would be being paid to drive would be exercising a privilege. The one who's exercising a right would be driving to the store to get a carton of milk or something. So I think I would like to see the ambiguity taken out of the Motor Vehicle Code, make it applicable to who it's designed for, and relieve the traffic public out here some of the multitudes of traffic citations that are issued without just cause. Thank you.
Is there any further witnesses? Seeing none, is there any further business to come before the committee today? Meeting adjourned.